people showed up who are new arrivals to the village this week. I've just finished 1 week myself, so I'm somewhat of a new welcomer. And the title for the session tonight is Seeking Shalom on the Home Front, the Domestic Costs of the Gulf War. It's a long title, but I hope to evoke some discussion from that. I'd like to begin by returning to the speech from Martin Luther King Jr. that I used on Monday, which is entitled Beyond Vietnam. It was a speech that he gave April 4th, 1967, exactly 1 year to the day before he was assassinated. And it was his first public stand against the Vietnam War. And it's a speech that contains many things, but I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned from this speech for us today. And I want to take one paragraph as a sort of way of introducing some of the concerns for this evening and maybe summing up for those of you who've been to one or more sessions during the week some of the issues we've tried to deal with. There is something seductively tempting about stopping there and sending us all off on what in some circles has become the popular crusade against the war in Vietnam. I say we must enter that struggle, but I wish to go on now to say something even more disturbing. The war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the American spirit. And if we ignore this sobering reality, we will find ourselves organizing clergy and laymen concerned committees for the next generation. They will be concerned about Guatemala and Peru. They will be concerned about Thailand and Cambodia. They will be concerned about Mozambique and South Africa. We will be marching for these and a dozen other names and attending rallies without end. Unless there is a significant and profound change in American life and policy. Such thoughts take us beyond Vietnam, but not beyond our calling as children of the living God. I'd like to take those words of King to heart tonight and have us wrestle with the next generation. We're here again. It's a different war, and I don't want to suggest that we get caught up in comparing this war to Vietnam positively or negatively, but to take that message of that there's a more profound problem here than just did we win the war or lose the war, were we opposed to the war or in favor of the war, but address what has been the real impact. And that's why I talked about, the title suggested domestic costs, and I want to say what impact has this war had on our communities. And while costs is a financial term and suggests, you know, just monetary things, I want to expand that and really encourage us to think about what has been the impact in varieties of ways in your own communities. And to start off with, I'd like to ask, which I haven't done in some of the other things, and I think that's a mistake, but how many folks in the room tonight have a relative or close friend or someone they know that served in the Gulf and either was over there in the back or is still over there? Let's get a show of hands. So it's at least a third, possibly. A half of the group. That's low for most of the groups that I've addressed. In most of our group, many of the groups that I've talked with, it's like 80 or 90% of the people in the room. That's neither here nor there. But I think it's important to realize that we're all affected in some ways, and we probably all know people in our communities that serve. That's just one way. The war itself, as we've talked over the week, has had effect on the media. And so what I'd like to do is take a few moments to begin with for folks to just turn to your neighbors again and just reflect on whatever comes to mind as things that you've thought about in your own community. Immediate, long-range effects. A number of folks have voiced concerns over the past week that have suggested some of these things. So take a few moments to share with the person next to you or in groups of three. What have been some of the costs or consequences of the war, impact of the war, whatever is the most helpful term, in your communities? And then we'll share some of that and see where we can go with that. So let's just take a moment to turn to the folks next to you. Okay, has everyone had a chance to share? Even if you hadn't, let's... Let me invite you now to share some of the things that came up, and we'll try and get them out and discuss some of those a little bit. So what were some of the things folks talked about? I put up costs, casualties, consequences on the home front. There was definitely an awful lot of talking there, so see if we could summarize.
We saw a real strong return to patriotism.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Return. Patriotism. Others?
How many countries are we going to have to interfere with and start trying to protect?
Okay. How many to protect? Question mark. That's a two. T.O. Others?
One of the costs, I think, was an expectation of what we might be able to do, say, in the inner city. I think primarily in terms of schools. The problem is we haven't done it anyway. So, I mean, spending $80 billion and still saying you don't have any money for inner cities or schools, I think it's been a strange paradox.
Mm-hmm. No money for
domestic
schools at domestic spending. Okay. Uh-huh.
I teach first, second, and third grade children, And they got caught up in their patriotism, true, but they missed out on what the consequences were of the war. And sometimes that needs to come across also. They didn't get that message until some pictures came out in the newspaper showing some of the destruction.
Hmm. So it's, how would you phrase that? I mean, patriotism versus, by consequence, it sounds like you're talking about the devastation or damage,
right,
destruction.
Well, the whole truth wasn't out. There was a painted picture, so. Mm-hmm. War is seen as a good thing for children. I think small children,
okay,
think
so
that war is good. It was a game that we won.
War is good, a game, and we won. I'm just going to use the phrases here. Cause I think, and the second one is, in some sense, a casualty is the whole truth. It sounds like what you were saying. Yeah.
That should be a little bit better defined. Casualty, the truth.
Do you want to say more?
Casualty.
Well, I would like to know, I mean, what kind of truth that we didn't know about. I mean, it was the most incredibly well-reported war. We're sitting there in Baghdad. We're seeing, you know, the tanks roll, we know exactly what's going on. I don't know the truth that was covered up.
The truth was covered up was how many people were being killed on the other side.
There wasn't much news media about the gore or the tragedy that was going on to human lives.
But that was the exact point in the last mm-hmm. war, that all there was this tragedy and gore.
Well, I can't compare it. I can't compare that.
Yeah.
Well, we're good. Let me suggest that we're doing, in some sense, two things here, and I don't want us to get too confused. But one is to clarify, in some sense, what is the impact. Another is attaching a value judgment, because in some ways, I think, depending on your perspective, each of these could be seen in positive or negative or a number of different lights. You know,
one consequence was there was no solution. This hasn't been solved.
Okay.
After all the expenditure, loss of lives, there are no solutions. And I have a tendency to be quite supportive of the government's role in accomplishing the objective they set out to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, we didn't come up with a solution.
So that's...
It's all still open-ended.
Yeah.
We got the oil.
We got the oil. What do you mean we didn't accomplish our objective?
We accomplished the exact mandate that we had, really, which was to get Iraq out of the way.
Okay, let's hold on. I want to make sure we get out the range of casualties and impacts before we get into evaluating them all.
One of the things that I noticed among my colleagues who have sort of late teenage sons is they talked about how the previous year, particularly one couple, the previous year when their son turned 18, how they thought the Berlin Wall was coming down. It's really a good time to have children that age. And that suddenly that hopefulness, that optimism just evaporated. And suddenly it wasn't a good time anymore. And it wasn't only about their sons, but I think the fact that they had sons of draftable age made it really poignant for them and clear that one of the costs was the loss of the euphoria that we had the year before about a new world.
Okay. Loss of the, let me help me here. It's a complicated word here, euphoria. Okay, we got it.
That was because I didn't have to spell it.
and I'm going to put 1989. In Eastern Europe, which is mostly what the euphoria was about.
Mm-hmm.
Is that clear to folks?
I think a real sense of helplessness and fear, which ties in with that loss of euphoria, but people were just plain scared again.
Okay, so, people here.
In my community, as we said, in church or in Bible study groups, it mm-hmm. was... There's nothing we can do.
Or powerlessness, helplessness, that's good, okay. And then we're gonna move over to the side. Go ahead.
Deanne had a nice thing about loss of euphoria, but what we actually talked about in our group here was that at a community level, we really talked about how cheap it was. I mean, that the cost really didn't seem to be that great, and so we really looked at it in economic or marketing terms.
So war is cheap?
It's cheap, doesn't cost that much, pretty easy, so very little quick.
Our allies picked up the tab.
You know, I think that we have to recognize that there has been some economic depression and job loss. Certainly,
yeah,
because
but what we meant was the way people feel about it, that the sort of
I want to distinguish that in terms of impact, we're dealing with a range of things in terms of feelings, impressions, which when you sort these out, you may discover that that impact may in fact not be as real as it's felt, but that we need to acknowledge that that's where people are at, and then see what we do with that. So that, I think that's important to sort out.
Yeah, this
I mean, there's still an awful lot of debate as to exactly how much did this war cost and exactly who's paying for it. But the fact that people were feeling that the war was cheap is an important thing to think about. So, Paula, you had something, and then...
War is now a game that women can play.
Okay,
Say it again.
War is now a game that women can play. Let's see. I'm going to write women warriors or something. Women in war. I'll state it in a.
Polly and then.
I question the loss of euphoria in regards to the parades and marches, and that didn't seem like loss of euphoria to me. I think that depending on what groups you're looking at, there was a lot of euphoria in some groups.
So maybe we should say. We could also say a gain
maybe
of
Christians
you.
Lost euphoria, or I don't know, even if you can.
How about we put that, you know, in some sense, some communities did experience a loss of euphoria, others experienced a gain. Would that get John?
Just for the sake of giving another viewpoint, one of the communities that I related to during the war were the financial community. And just about everything that's been said so far can be seen on the flip side in those, in financial terms, in economic terms, in that and the questions are, how can we profit from this great happening that's unfolding in front of us? And the euphoria there at the start of the war was at a very high level. Previous to that, in a technological sense, where markets were very worried about the Japanese taking over with their technological advantage, and all of a sudden with the war now, the missiles work, isn't this great, stock market takes off, everything is wonderful, aren't we swell? In terms of the war being cheap, maybe in human terms, and in terms of what we expected it to cost, it was cheap, but in terms of how the markets view the war, This is a boon. Money's being spent. It's very expensive to conduct war, and the more missiles we shoot, the more we have to replace, the more we have to produce to replace them, and that makes the companies rich, and that makes the stockholders rich.
So war is good for business. So.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it also shows a kind of technology. I mean, it was at its highest peak, and for that, looking at the positive side, the technology was unbelievable, and on the negative side, could it be used for some other purpose that's much more valuable?
Yeah.
Well, that's another sort of relates to the question last night of yellow journalism, because the impression is that the technology was great, but the reality was that it really wasn't so great. It really didn't work as well as we were told it worked.
Do you know what percent? Just
I talked to some pilots, and they sure thought it worked.
I'm going to put role of technology, so we keep it general.
I had something on the cost, possibly the families and maybe a million lives. Human loss, I think, is a terrific cost of this.
Yeah, the human suffering. And not just those who lost their lives, but... Okay.
One other thing that we lost in the United States was the burden and paralysis of Vietnam syndrome.
Okay, so the...
We created some new heroes.
Paralysis of Vietnam.
Okay.
You've been wanting to speak for a while.
Yeah, I'm listening to all of this with interest. I'm a Canadian, so I can't relate in the same way as you people can, and yet we felt it too because we were involved as well. And I guess I feel personally some of the helplessness and all that stuff, that again we had to resort to this kind of madness to settle something that was questionable in its motives and so on, as my opinion is that way. I don't know what it did for our country, except perhaps to, we have to wonder now, are Canadians still looked at in the peacekeeping role as they always had a tradition of being looked at, and has that hurt our image in that way? And I don't know if we know the consequences of that yet, but that's certainly one thing our government wrestled with when we're deciding whether or not to get involved and how involved should we get.
So national image.
That we've been drawn into something that we haven't been drawn into.
For Canada, I think, although the same is true for the U.S., is how we're perceived worldwide.
Yeah.
Well, and who the bad guys are. I spent a year in Japan, and it used to be Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And now all the bashing has gone to Japan for what they did or didn't do in this role.
Mm-hmm. So who the new bad guys? I'm going to do that with the creation of enemies.
And couldn't we say friends to that? Because I think, I also think there was a great sense of solidarity among a number of nations as a result of the war.
So creation of friends as well. Okay, I'm trying to get... Okay, somebody, is there someone back
there? I noticed a split in the community. You know, there was the patriotism, but there was still, when a peace group met down at the post office, people that I knew in both groups were all of a sudden antagonistic to each other. And it came up in our church too, because the question of the flag and the sanctuary, I mentioned
right,
this before.
We're talking about
that. All of a sudden the church was real. There was, we had a congregational meeting about whether we should have the flag in the sanctuary or not. It hadn't been there for 17 years, and all of a sudden, now it's a big issue. And there were people that are, you know, mild people that never speak up. We're talking at a loud voice, and I mean, I was a brand new church council president. I was the
So tell us quickly, what's the answer? What are we supposed to do? What did you do?
Well, we set up a committee to study it, and the committee decided that we would display the flag in the narthex. And then they have it, and the committee was to decide how it was to be displayed, and nothing has happened since that time.
So, and where is the flag at this point? Is it there?
The flag now is in the corner in the fellowship room behind the piano. I mean, it's not.
Okay. I think that's important to acknowledge it. I mean, it's on one level it's humorous, but it gets to real deep divisions within communities. And how do we, as people of faith, deal with those divisions? Do we, like, sweep them under the rug? Or do we let them come out in the surface and acknowledge that we are a divided community, we don't agree? You know, what do we do with that? Do we try and outshout the other group? You know, or sort of work behind the scenes of, you know, like, well, the flag hasn't made it to sanctuary yet, so we'll just leave it where it is, and we'll sort of delay, and then our side will get its way. I mean, but I think there's something to say that the extent to which, I'm not sure, has been acknowledged in all places, that the war did really divide communities and churches in particular.
I think the whole concept of interpersonal relations and the idea that you have a friend. I mean, I know in our church we had two or three doctors that went over to be there and formed a Christian fellowship group over there. And that kind of how you keep that relationship when you have, as you say, this one group who are somewhat antagonistic to it, some who are patriotic about it, and some who are not sure which way to go, but they don't care to offend either one.
That's a very interesting point, is that the talking about patriotism, you know, being patriotic or being antagonistic, in some ways there's groups like, how many folks have heard of worked with the Military Family Support Network? Does anybody know that? Anybody heard of the Military Family Support Network? That's an extraordinary group, and it was started by one man, from the University of Wisconsin,
and his son was drafted in the Marines and was sent over to Saudi Arabia in August. And he wrote a letter to the editor, in effect, that got published in the New York Times and a number of other papers around the country, basically saying, President Bush, if my son gets killed, I can't forgive you. And explains the situation of why he felt this was a terrible war, and yet he wanted to be supportive of his son, and the issues and tensions that he felt as a parent and as a citizen in relation to what his government was doing. He got so many letters from people around the country saying, I feel the exact same thing. I have a brother or a sister or a parent or a child that's in the Gulf. And I don't know how to be supportive, because frankly, I don't think they're there for the right reasons. And Military Family Support Network is a group of folks nationwide that within a few months developed chapters in like 20 different places of family members, and it's all family members, although there's other folks who can be supportive and work with them, who felt that the best way to be patriotic and the best way to support their own family members over in the Gulf was to work as hard as possible to get them home and to resolve the conflict and the crisis diplomatically and through sanctions rather than through military force. Which is an interesting notion, because they came at this obviously with a very personal stake, but also with a very patriotic sense, and therefore, you know, as we look down this list, many of the terms, like what does it mean to be patriotic, they were often seen as part of the opposition and therefore not worthy of attention in the media when they asked the media to cover their events. And they got very little coverage in most of the different things that they did. But they provided a range of services for all the folks and networking, and really was, I think, quite a model of hope of, you know, in a situation like this where you're really torn of what you do, folks trying to come together and just sharing experiences. When someone got a letter from a loved one over there, they would share the information, because what they realized was that the letters that they were getting did not at all match the experiences of what they were seeing on television or reading in the paper. And there was a real gap there, so they said, we've got to make our own network of providing information here. So, similar to your church experience there, is this is another way in terms of folks responding to those splits. Any other comments, folks?
I work in a rural minority community, and in that community, many families support income by membership in the National Guard, so that it had a great impact on that community. But what I saw at the high school was the recruitment officers hit hard, and I bet statistically you could see that they were able to recruit young people, young minorities, like they hadn't in the past.
So those recruitment issues, and particularly minority. So you're saying particularly recruitment of minority. Okay. Polly, did you?
My community during and after the war was a university community, and what I saw during the war was intensity on both sides, opposition and in favor, and now what I see is absolutely nothing. Like, it's almost like a quick fix, and it's over, and it was high, and it's, you know, the leaders of tomorrow were very intense about it at the moment, but there's no discussion, there's nothing. It's almost like it never happened. So I can't even say that that's a consequence or a cost, or I don't know what that is.
Right. Well, that's part of what we're, the other part of the title for this evening session, which I want to move to, is seeking shalom. In other words, I think we can focus on the war. Did we win it or did we not? You know, if you strict military terms, that itself is up for question. Did we accomplish our goals or did we not? Hussein is still in power. So, I mean, militarily, clearly we beat Iraq in some sense. But then if you push the question further and ask, did we win the peace as opposed to war? What does it mean to win the peace in the Middle East? What does it mean to win the peace, shalom? And how many folks know what shalom, the range of meanings for shalom? I'm going to put this up. put Salome in the corner here. I mean, it's a traditional Hebrew greeting. It means wholeness, peace, a variety of different terms. There's an Arabic word that and in terms of seeking shalom, what I want to suggest is that this war has had a profound impact in a variety of ways in our society. And that question of, you know, sort of intensity and focusing on it and 24-hour day coverage that gradually shifted back to it was just the major factor in the news, but still just one piece of regular news broadcasts again. And the New York Times, which is one of the papers I follow most closely, being from New York, has developed this sort of, there's some special issue in the world that deserves a section of 2 to 4 pages, generally, inside the paper, and it's sort of, crisis in the Gulf. And I sort of watched that, and then it was, moved from crisis in the Gulf to the Gulf War, and then the Gulf War aftermath, and, had a number of different titles, I don't remember. And at some point, in June, that section disappeared. And Yugoslavia became the new focus for a special section in the Times. And if you go out there today, you can find a special section on Yugoslavia in the last few issues of the New York Times. And you'll find articles on the Middle East, but they're no longer, set up. And that's, again, raises this question of how do we sort out wars don't, have lifelong consequences for the people over there, but also for our country here in terms of people coming back as veterans. And I think we've got a lot of issues to try and sort out here, as we've had all week, and in some sense, it's arbitrary where we go within an hour. And I'd like to highlight a couple of these and just maybe focus on them further, and then take the last part, the last few minutes that we have, and ask what I'm hoping we'll move for is how is it that we, in this context of division, like the church there, the campus, communities, how do we seek shalom? How do we seek wholeness and a reconciliation that isn't a glossing over of issues? But a genuine coming to terms with disagreements, with differences, with the pain and suffering, and trying to eliminate that. And for when you have a sense of some folks feeling great pride and some folks feeling extraordinary injustice and shame at what's going on, you've got major poles here. And I think there's a temptation for all of us to say, well, the other side is out to lunch and wrong, and I'll just ignore them and do my thing. And what I want to encourage us to wrestle with is that what King says in his speech is that if we don't address those deeper divisions, and he had in mind some issues that are still around today, of racism that divides our society, and that the war of Vietnam, this war as well, plays into pre-existing divisions in our society. And that can be an opportunity for us to address those, but it can also be a means of disguising them and pushing them down and, pouring salt in the wound or whatever. I'd like to highlight just a couple things myself that I've observed and ask in sort of in the form of questions or comments. One is, this war is good. I've been amazed that, I think this is not new with the Gulf War, but I think there's a sense in which war has become really a metaphor for problem solving and conflict resolution in our society. That there's a war on drugs, we have a war on crime, take your pick, there was a war on poverty, whatever it might be, that we use military terms, the battle of the sexes. Take your pick, think of the way in which the military and military metaphors of conquest, of fighting, permeate our society. I don't think that's just our society or just recently, but I want to suggest that the war further legitimizes and normalizes that as a good way of defining stuff.
I have an image of that. I was on campus and walking by quickly to my bus, and there was a peace group during the war, and they were using red paint to signify blood for a peace demonstration. That disturbed me the way it was, so I kept walking. I had to get to my bus, and as I was coming over the bridge, a placard that said fight racism, and I just went, get me out of here. You know, that's exactly what we see everything as, fight.
Yeah. I mean, we could just open a hymnal.
Yeah.
Fight the good fight, onward Christian soldiers, good military metaphors there. And I want to suggest that some of that, in terms of life, is full of struggle, and to suggest that we eliminate all military metaphors eliminates at least a part of reality. But the question is how one evaluates that. Is that good or bad? Wars are a part of our experience. But my question is, when is it that that language, military language, becomes, and military forms of resolving issues become good? In other words, where have we talked about waging a peace campaign on behalf of drugs and drug abuse? You know, it's not as catchy. We're going to have a peace campaign to end substance abuse? Just, you know, or a peace campaign to clean up the streets? You know, we're not as excited. None of us get, you know, it's not like, you got to fight. You got to do that. You know, when we go to football games, we don't go sort of cooperate.
That's exactly the point. It brings it home. If you say we're going to have a war on poverty, we're going to have a war on drugs, it identifies exactly what you want to do. You want a definite victor, which is what war is all about. There is going to be a victor. There's going to be a loser. If you're going to have a war on poverty, you hope to God that the loser is poverty. I don't see what's good or what's bad about that. It's like, you know, society is ingrained with sports analogies as well. It's just part of it. War's been a part of, you know, history and will continue. This is not the last
war.
The U.S.
then?
Is going to be... Yeah. As a matter of fact, to the 3 million people sitting in Kuwait, war was a great thing.
The 3 million, I'm not sure about it. They've got a lot of
especially,
oil.
It was 2.5 after the one year after Iraq came in, right?
The Palestinians, of the 3 million people there, most of them were non-Kuwaitis.
Regardless, they're people who were invaded, and the war that the U.S. waged was a good war, which granted them the freedom that they deserved because they were unjustly invaded.
Well, that's a matter of debate, I think. We'll see. This week, I'm actually going to address
The debate would be that you think it was a good thing that they were invaded.
No.
It's a good thing that they were relieved of that.
No, sometimes... I mean, I don't want to dwell on this point too much, but I think it's important to acknowledge is, in some sense, what we were fighting for and what we accomplished. And I guess one analogy that I would give is if I cut my hand and I'm bleeding profusely, if I put a tourniquet on my neck, I'm not sure that that's going to be a helpful response. In other words,
so you don't,
sometimes the cure can be worse than the problem.
But what happens if you put a tourniquet just above the
exactly.
Yeah.
That would be good.
Yeah. So you think it was an old...
The question is, was the cure of stopping Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, which is a wrong...
Was it the proper cure?
Was that the most effective cure, or was it a cure that, in effect, led to far more devastation and destruction and problems than there was with the problem?
That's an
initial problem.
Unanswerable question, simply because of the fact that if we had let, you know, appeasement didn't work in 1937, it was not going to work in 1991.
Right.
You know, Saddam,
two years
from now, would go after Saudi Arabia, whatever. If he did, then what are you going to do? So
I think that's
an
important
how you can answer that
let's
question.
I spoke about this this past week, but let's look at Eastern Europe. End of World War II, there were some generals who wanted to take on the Soviet Union. Stalin is an enemy. And if we don't contain him now, if we don't stop communism now, well, we didn't wage that war. And
we spent 40 years trying to win it. Yeah.
But 40 years later, the whole place turned upside down. This incredible transformation in a relatively nonviolent fashion. And
I want to stress that making too close a correlation between one experience and another, between what happened with Hitler and Hussein, I personally don't think there's any comparison between the two, apart from the fact that they're both very brutish, you know, nasty people who have very little regard for human life. But in terms of power and experience of Nazi Germany and Iraq, they were very different countries in very different times and very different things going on.
I think, getting back to the language of war and how we use it domestically, I think what it does is it lets us be disconnected from social structures and problems. When we talk about a war on poverty, to say poverty is not connected to people is poverty is connected to people. And in the same way that we can do that war on drugs, war on poverty, where I can disconnect myself as a white middle class woman from a war on poverty because poverty is this invisible enemy, I think we can do that with the language about the war in the Middle East, where I'm not connected to the people who are dying and wherever. And I think that's, that can't, to me, that's what language like war on poverty does. It says poverty is out there, it's not connected to me, it's not connected to people, it's a sort of invisible enemy. And that denies the realities of social structures that I participate in.
Well, one of the important dynamics of war is to dehumanize and depersonalize the enemy. To kill someone that you know, that you love, is done, but it's a very hard thing to do. To kill a gook, a communist, a label, whatever it might be, a terrorist, to kill someone you can never see because they're on the other side of an electronic battlefield, is very different. And I think one of the profound casualties of the war was the extent to which it depersonalized things even further. Most of the folks fighting never saw a body until after the fact, when the ones that were on the highway to hell and some of the ground troops saw folks that they had to clean up after and put into mass graves, but not before that. And there's something about that suddenly war loses the intimate quality, because violence is very intimate. Anyone who's experienced sexual abuse, domestic violence, knows that there is nothing impersonal about it. It's very personal. And all forms of violence for anybody who's the victim is extraordinarily personal. You're dead, you're wounded, your family is grieving, you're grieving for somebody. And that's lost when you say this. I mean, and there's a lot of phrases. For me, one of the most poignant one was the advertisements that appeared, sometimes as advertisements, but Newsweek actually carried it as a cover story about the stealth bomber. And it says, the stealth bomber, it saves lives. Well, the goal of a bomber is to drop bombs to destroy at least things, if not people. To say that that dropping weapons of mass destruction saves lives is a very interesting twist.
But it's an absolute truth. It's an absolute truth. Of course it kills some, but we dropped a bomb on Hiroshima, and if we hadn't dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, we would have lost, you know, I've seen millions of men invading Japan.
If we invade
it. I'll tell you, if it saves one American life,
so
that's great.
How many non-American lives does one American life equal, would you say?
I mean
that's a hard question. I don't want you to answer it. But when you say one American life is worth something, that suggests that other lives are not worth the same amount.
It sounds like a racist statement.
And to me, the theme, and this, it's very hard. It's very hard because, you know, it's not an easy thing, because that's what all nations say. Hussein actually probably thought that Iraqi lives were fairly equal to anybody else's lives. He was willing to sacrifice anybody's. But if you think of the theme for this summer, the image of God, in my mind, one of the most painful experiences of the Gulf War was watching one image of God after another being snuffed out, being deformed, as a victim and as a perpetrator. Because we were teaching people to kill and that was good. And in my mind, and this is important, something to wrestle with,
when you talk about war and the just war, the just war teaching is quite clear, as opposed to the pacifist thing, that wars may be justified. They are never good. Never good. They are always seen as a necessary evil in the Christian tradition, or as an absolute evil from the pacifist tradition. That's been lost in this. There's really a crusade mentality of, we won, we kicked the Vietnam syndrome, you know, there's all sorts of good things that come out. Where is the place? I mean, even if one feels the war was justified and you needed to stop Hussein, I think it's important to acknowledge that there are many people that feel that. I don't, but holding that position and feeling you need to stop Hussein, where is the place for mourning the destruction that happened in doing that? That yes, we stopped, but there was an extraordinary loss of life. Iraq will never be the same sort of society, and the people who didn't like Hussein particularly well are the ones suffering the most, and not Hussein. So it gets to, you know, I think it really pushes an awful lot when we start evaluating more like this. So I hope we're getting to the end.
When we use a metaphor of war, what's brought home to me very vividly when I went to a presentation about war and peace and art, and the person who made his presentation got all done, and we looked at him and said, you didn't have any pictures of peace. He said, well, you know, that's really interesting. There aren't very many pictures of peace in art. And he said, I think the reason is that our notion of peace is so static and so uninteresting that there's nothing happening. And as I look at the things that we have up there, even that euphoria of Eastern Europe came because something was changing. Right, we see something happening. It was very exciting to see the wall come down and a new world opening up in front of us. Well, war is exciting. And there's no way around it. It's very exciting. A lot of my students talked about that. They said, yeah, I'm surprised at myself, but I watch and I get really drawn in. It's so dynamic. Stuff is changing really fast. And it's appealing. So that if we want to contrast war with shalom is a concept that has the possibility of a dynamic, exciting, changing world, rather than how we often think of peace.
Yeah, that's a very important point.
I think that's a good point. I had the opportunity to visit Israel about 3 years ago. And there I sensed a sense of shalom, a sense of building, a sense of excitement about what they were doing. And I'm not judging that right or wrong, but that peace was exciting to them. Then I come back, and I think if we ask probably 99% of the 6 million Israelis if this war was good, they would say, oh yes, indeed, it was very good.
Okay. Actually, that's a good commercial for one of the sessions this week. Will be on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And I encourage folks to come. There's a video, a 20-25 minute video on that, the history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is very good. But I want to return to sort of pull together the Deanne's comment. And we sat down and had lunch, and you told me
Bryce.
Okay, Bryce made about the sort of one American versus, you know, saving lives and the war is exciting. And I want to say one of the things that the peace movement did was that it was not a peace movement. It was an anti-war movement. And the main thing that many groups said was, it's going to be another Vietnam. It's going to be another devastating form of mass destruction and body bags coming home. And that will be unacceptable. And what I want to pose is, as Christians, what have we done when we start saying only massive casualties is unthinkable? I said this in one session before, but maybe it bears repeating, is that Joseph Stalin, who went to seminary, by the way. I don't know if folks know that, but folks know that Joseph Stalin was a seminary student. David Stockman is a seminary student. They're the only two sort of who chose an alternative career among many. But it's interesting to know, I mean, as someone who's gone to seminary and still at seminary, I'm always interested in fellow seminarians, but Joseph Salatin said, one death is a tragedy. 1,000 deaths is a statistic. And he was pretty good at statistics. And the point there is that you lose humanity. We lose that intimacy, which war is very, you know, does bring back, you know, some, it's exciting, there's some intimacy to it in some ways, but you lose a lot of that personal aspect that any death of any person is a tragedy. You know, our community, somewhat from a distance, shared the tragedy of a hiker falling off a ledge this week. And to try and just multiply that and say, okay, there were 300 and something Americans, so it's 300 times as bad as what we experienced with this one young man, or 100,000, 200,000 Iraqis, the numbers game is not going to work. It loses the point that every single death is a tragedy, for whatever reason that it might happen. And there's a grieving community of relatives and friends that are affected by that. And the peace movement really didn't pick up on that. And that's why I think we got stuck in some sense, those of us opposed to the war. It was some sense a lack of vision of not saying there's an alternative here. There were folks who really were pushing for alternatives and trying to be more creative. But that's hard. I mean, I think that point is really hard. So other comments here?
I don't think the peace movement, maybe this goes along with what you said, but I don't think they're very creative. By that sense, I mean, why can't you be part of the peace movement and display an American flag? Mm-hmm. All right? I mean, you know, why can't you?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, just
the Military Family Support Network was the one example that did that.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you looked at many of the anti-war demonstrations, the two major marches in Washington in January that had been scheduled before the war started, this was probably the only war I know of that was scheduled by deadline and then waged. And also, the protests, the dissent scheduled opposition to it before it started, and then folks arrived. You know, in other words, two demonstrations for Washington, D.C. had been, and for San Francisco had been set up for the last weeks of January. The war deadline was January 15th. The war starts, the opposition marches, you know, sort of like this orchestrated Act 1, Act 2, Act 3, close, set, you know, go home.
Part of the reason that the peace movement was deemed not creative was that it was so small. It really was a small group of people, less than, and polls coming out right when the war started before were less than 10%.
45% of the people before the war were opposed to use of military force. Is that a peace movement?
I mean, No, I don't think so. I don't think that statistic's anywhere near accurate.
Well, it was exact. The point I'm making here is that there's not just peace at any cost versus war. There were a lot of people who thought that 47 senators, 100 and something representatives, and millions of people around this country and millions of people around the world who felt that there was an opportunity to use sanctions, diplomatic channels, and a variety of other things to pressure someone who was an outlaw by any standard of law into complying with international law. And there were some real opportunities there. That takes time. If anybody's participated in legal proceedings or watched legal proceedings, you forget what the initial struggle was or conflict was by the time there's a resolution. It goes on for years.
You can only allow, I mean, the women and the children and the people of Kuwait were being brutalized by the day. And you can't just sit on the Saudi border and watch this go on, too. I mean, well, the same humanistic view that you take should take into account the fact that there were thousands of women being raped and the country was being pillaged beyond recognition. And you know, for us just to sit there and just to say, well, okay, we're watching the
clock. But see, the assumption
let this go and go. Right. That doesn't make sense to me.
No,
I don't know, if, you know, you can give sanctions the time to work.
Okay, let's hear from some
they can.
Folks, well.
I think that that sort of thing has happened many times around the world where we have not intervened. What's the difference?
Right.
Oil. I don't think that we were being I don't think it was altruistic at all.
It was for all.
I think it was.
Pol Pot killed a million people in Cambodia, and most people don't know about it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he has skulls, like roomfuls of skulls he had. And no one knows that. And here it's a few people. If you want to talk numbers.
The other thing, just in passing, is within the Middle East itself, if you don't, I mean, I think you can look at dictatorships around the world where the United States has said hands off or actively supported somebody. Marcos was not a particularly nice guy in the Philippines, and we consistently sent money to him. So even in the Middle East, you say Hussein is this terrible, brutal guy, which he is. In 1980, when Iraq invaded Iran, 500,000 to 1 million people lost their lives in 8 years. The United States was not at the forefront of international outcry to say, let's stop Iraq, let's come to Iran's aid. Why? Well, Iran was our enemy, so we sent weapons instead to Iraq. We thought Hussein was a good guy at that point. Sure, he gassed his people. Sure, you know, he used these nasty weapons, but hey, you know, he's serving our interests in the region. We play crass politics the way any other nation does. So I think it's important to acknowledge. The other major thing, and this gets to some of the national image around the world, if you look beyond, we've been trying to focus more on the home front today, but if you look at the image around the world, the United Nations condemned very quickly Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, and it got universal support. Virtually universal support with the United Nations, incredible cooperation. 24 years earlier, the United Nations condemned Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and the Golan Heights and said that the acquisition of territory by force is inadmissible. 24 years later, there's still a military occupation of those lands. There are no troops massed at the border, and in fact, the United States has systematically blocked any efforts to penalize Israel beyond a certain level of just sort of public outcry. And so there's some inconsistencies there. Imagine what the Arab world feels in watching the United States come to the aid of one country but not another. Just a second. You had wanted to say something. No, you. Okay, it's passed. Okay. I want to take a little time now to sort of try and deal with what that would look like. That may not be an easy task, and we're running out of time. So do folks want to what would be most helpful in our last sort of minute or two together here, which is, I think, symptomatic in some sense that, you know, we get caught up in the issues, and yet when it comes to, you know, this part is much harder, so it's a lot easier to put off to the end. Polly?
I don't have any answers to that, but I just want to make an observation about, we're talking about divisions, and we have a division here, definitely, mm-hmm. and I'm feeling really uncomfortable. I'm like, all I want to do is like, shut it off, no, don't say that, it makes me feel really bad, and I have no idea how to like come to terms with it. It seems like we're just so opposite, so opposed, that how can you ever feel whole or come together on any sort of feeling okay, even that you're opposing it. It's almost like put it out of your mind and don't think about that there's people who think exactly the opposite of what you think.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay.
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. You want? Okay. What about King? What did King say? How does America have to change? Yeah, and I thought that was very appropriate what you read there. What do we have to change? And I think every one of us, you know, I want power. I want power over other people, and that's really what war is power over other people, and that's what we want, and that's the thing that we've got to fight.
Mm-hmm. There's two last comments here.
Go ahead. You didn't have your chance.
Well, what this gentleman is saying, I think, is kind of where I've been through that whole thing. It was like there was such a confusion of American values of the past. Which is love your neighbor, take care of the other soul who is in dire straits, whatever. And so the flag became a new symbol, and that was very disturbing to me, because I have always, you know, loved my flag. I think about the flag flying above our schools, how it has been this symbol of peace. And all of a sudden it became a symbol of war. And I don't ever remember a time of, in my lifetime of reading about a parade where we were putting military machinery down the street. I don't ever remember that.
The parades look very similar to Red Square, if you didn't know who was marching.
Or to 1945.
1945, yeah.